Hi, my name is Daniel Sockwell, although some of you may know me better by my username CodeSections, which is the username I use on the AccuIRC channel or on the subreddit. Feel free to reach out to me in either of those places or anywhere else, or at my website, codesections.com, if you'd like to discuss this talk afterwards. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And today's topic, I'm going to be talking about dependency management and sort of more broadly lessons that Raku can learn from other programming languages that are more targeted at solving the problems of large software organizations. In particular, because of a talk I gave at FOSDEM last year, and I'm hoping to save a fair amount of time from this talk for your to take questions and hear your thoughts. This is a topic that I've been giving a lot of thought to over the last year, but it's also one that I still feel like I don't have figured out, so I'm very much hoping to hear other people's thoughts and feedback as well. Diving in, last year I gave a talk entitled Imagining the Ideal Programming Language for Writing Free Software, and I talked about how Raku is a really great language for writing free software, and I contrasted Raku, which I said is ideal for small groups of programmers, perhaps even individuals writing free software, to big teams working for a large corporation. And I stand by what I said there, but I've also had some thoughts that sort of cut in the opposite direction. So to say exactly what I mean, I want to play a clip from my talk last year and then talk about a little bit about what I still believe and what I don't quite believe. So here's that clip.
But I think that environment is very different from the sort of solo developer, free software, or code as novel environment that is really important for a free software language to target. To explain what I mean, I'd like to look at three different features of the big tech environment compared to the free software code as novel environment, and then for each of those features, look at how that feature of the environment impacts the language design goals of a language targeting that sort of environment. So first, in big tech, you have really large teams. In small teams in free software, as we've talked about pretty extensively, big tech also has high turnover. Just like the law firm I worked at, it's not at all uncommon for people to start their career there before quickly moving on to somewhere else, and they're sort of constantly hiring from people who have just completed their CS education. Free software, on the other hand, a lot of these small projects have one maintainer for decades, but even if it's not quite to that extreme, the turnover is much, much lower. In big tech, people are there because they're getting a paycheck. They may have other motivations as well, but that is a sort of defining feature of the job, is that it is a job. Pre-software developers tend to be much more self-motivated. They may or may not be getting paid at all. If they are, they're getting paid probably less than they would make at a different way that they could be spending their time. So the motivation is pretty different. So how do those features of the big tech environment impact design goals of a language targeting that environment?
So basically, my model last year was that there was a spectrum that looks something like this, where you have a big company, a big tech company, that in every way is on sort of the opposite end of the spectrum from a free software project, you know, whether that's team size or turnover or motivation, you know, big tech, huge team, high turnover, monetary motivation. It's on the exact opposite end of the spectrum of a free software project. And then, you know, some sort of small company is somewhere in between those two extremes, but very much sort of tilted towards the big company side, where you're still, you still have a significant size team, you still have a significant amount of turnover, you still have a significantly monetary incentive base for the work you're doing there. And so those are both sort of on the same side of the spectrum generally, and free software is sort of the odd one out. And thus some of the design choices that Raku makes are motivated by that way in which free software is on sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. And I still generally believe that, and I stand by pretty much everything I said in that talk, but I've come to believe also that there are at least a few ways where that's less the case, where instead of free software being on the opposite end of the spectrum, free software is on the same end of the spectrum as big tech, and the opposite end as a small company. But free software is not opposite of big tech. It's big tech, but even more so. And to show an example of where one area where I think this is true, and the area that got me thinking about this is dependency management. So let me play a clip from the talk that sort of clued me into this, which is a talk by Russ Cox, one of the leading developers of Go, talking about Go as compared to free software and how Google's software environment relates to a free software environment.
Versions are absolutely necessary for software engineering. They are how you explain, both to tools and to other programmers, which code to use, even though that code is changing over time. Versions are especially necessary in large-scale software engineering, where there are many other programmers, and the code has to keep working for a very long time. Now, when I say large-scale software engineering, some people think of programs at a large company like Google. But in many ways, Google is small. We have all our code in one place. We can find all uses of a given package. We can list all the programmers working on a given program. In contrast, consider open source development on the internet. The code is not all in one place. We can't find all the uses of a given package. We can't list all the programmers working on a given program. This is the setting where we most need good support for versioning to simplify software engineering.
So to expand on what Russ Cox was saying there a little bit, you know, imagine that in a small company, you might have a team of five or six other developers who use the library that you're writing. If you want to make a breaking change to that library, you can sit down in a room with those five or six people using your code and tell them, you know, this is the change I want to make. Can we all get on board and all upgrade at the same time and everyone stop using the old version? And you can sit around and have that conversation. In a big tech company, it's theoretically possible to do that, to have that same sort of conversation, but much more challenging. You know, instead of five or six people, there, if you listed out all of the different departments and different teams that use the library that you're working on, it may be that there are 20 or 30 different teams, and each of those is not just one person, but is, you know, a different team within the organization. If you tried to get everybody on board, it would be a huge logistical challenge. In practice, it's going to be very difficult to coordinate upgrade paths. But in theory, you could do it. Free software, though, takes that practical difficulty of big tech and makes it actually a theoretical impossibility. You know, even if you were willing to go to a sort of infinite amount of trouble, it's just even in theory impossible to figure out, to have a complete list of everyone who is using your project. You know, someone can have downloaded it from the internet and you have, they are under no obligation to tell you. So like if you, there is no, even in theory, there is in principle no way to have a complete list of all of the people for whom your software is a dependency. So, you know, from that perspective, when looking at how you manage your dependencies, or rather how you think about your software from the perspective of who might be depending on it, unlike all of the ways I talked about last year, free software is not on the opposite end of the spectrum from big tech. Free software is facing the same problems as big tech, but turned up to 11, or from some perspective, turned up to infinity. You have a problem that is very hard to solve in big tech, is even in principle impossible to solve for free software in terms of listing everything, in terms of managing all of the users of your software. Why does that matter for dependency management? Well, I think it matters because of some of the problems that Russ Cox goes on to talk about in that talk for about Golang, and in specifically specifying dependencies in a way that allows a sort of clean upgrade path when you as a user of a dependency don't have a way of getting on the same page with all of the other users of a particular dependency, or put from the other perspective, when I, as the author of a library, don't have a way of coordinating with all of the users of my library. How does this relate to Vaku? Well, I think it relates in terms of the balance between two aspects that are very important to Vaku. And specifically, I'm thinking about the balance between what is sometimes called whip-uptitude, the ability to just easily whip up a script and get started with Vaku right away, and what you could call software engineering, the ability to make sort of very solid software that that works regardless of, or not regardless, that's the wrong way to put it, that is solid and dependable and will work at a much larger scale. You know, so one way that Vaku most obviously strikes that balance is you can just start declaring your code and just jump in right away, or you can declare types and have some of the benefits of, you know, more static type checking type code by declaring your types and declaring your function signatures and function return values and all of that. So, you know, in general, Vaku does a very good job of striking that balance where you can start by just whipping something up, and then as it progresses and becomes bigger, you can sort of slide along this continuum to as much rigor and as much sort of locking things in as you would like. And so I think that we do something similar with dependency management in a way that is not talked about quite as much in our documentation, and a way that I would like to draw more attention to, but But also in a way that is conceptually at least very similar to what we do with types and signatures and all of that. So for example, with when importing statements, you can just use a package. So I recently released the Lobar utility package, and the easiest way to use that is to just put the name of the package, in this case just an underscore, and just use it. But much like Golang's full import paths, we can also specify an exact version we can also add an auth to it. We have the ability to specify on a per file basis the exact version, the exact import path of each dependency, and that gives us the ability to be very specific, but also a bit verbose. You know, there is a big difference between just having a simple use statement versus a use statement that has ver something, and then maybe auth something, and we can add additional qualifications as well. So I guess it's up to the individual the authors of each individual file to decide where on this spectrum they want to place their dependency management. But what I'm struggling with, and what I would like to hear people's thoughts on, is what our community practices ought to be for this spectrum. You know, right now, the vast majority of the examples in our documentation have simple use statements that are unqualified. That's very much on the whipuptitude side of the spectrum. My instinct after thinking about this is that is good for simple scripts, but that we really ought to be encouraging people at the very least to specify full versions, and perhaps to also specify full import paths on anything that they intend to be more in the production side. And I'm also sort of giving thought to what practices we ought to have for encouraging sort of versioning best practices and that sort of practice for for software authors. Obviously, that's the sort of thing that happens through sort of ecosystem community norms, and not through any sort of tooling or any sort of official mandate, but I think that is equally important, and that's one of the points that it comes up in this talk, is cooperation is something that is absolutely key to having a well-functioning ecosystem. It's not something that you can sort of legislate or enforce through the programming language itself, but it's something that emerges emerges out of the ecosystem and out of the practices as practiced by individual authors and by individual users, and what the sort of community set of expectations is and what sort of accepted best practices are. So that's something that I'd be interested to hear people's thoughts on. And really, I would like all of this to be as much a, as I said, as much a the springboard for a conversation as it is for, as it is me sort of talking at you, which is why I really wanted to leave a lot of time for question and discussion. So if there's any takeaway from this, I'd like you to take away the idea that we don't have just one versioning system in Raku, we have an entire spectrum, but that for production software, I would encourage people to be a bit more on the explicit side of specifying their dependencies, not just on a per project basis, but actually on a per file basis. But that it's something that we really ought to not just take my word for, but come up with, as a community, come up with some thoughts about what our sort of consensus best practice is, and maybe even document that, or at least articulate it through our documentation in a way that does sort of express what that consensus view is. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So with that, I'm going to stop talking and hope that some of y'all will chime in with some thoughts and some perspectives on this, and maybe we'll reach a bit more of a agreement as a community.